Good evening, everybody. My name is Khan Cho. I'm a student here at the Zendo. And I'm so unused to giving Dharma talks that I was doing the chant and I looked down and I saw the notes before me and I realized, oh, I'm giving the talk. So I was quick, unfold. Anyway, do you all know the nursery rhyme, Curiosity Killed the Cat? I thought there might be a kind of a long verse to that, so I looked it up online, Curiosity Killed the Cat. And apparently the second line is, Satisfaction Brought Him Back. But that's not what I learned growing up. I learned Curiosity Killed the Cat, Information Made Him Fat. And the implication is that he gorged himself on information and died, And, I've been thinking about information a lot recently because for some reason, it's not that hard to figure out. I've been recoiling from the internet. I can't touch it. It's like touching a live wire or something. I don't think I've posted on Facebook in like 4 months. And, I'd like to be able to go there. I just can't do it. So I'm troubled by my own impulses when it comes to consuming information, particularly the news. I need to know what's going on. And so I'm always just, reading the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever. So I started thinking about what is this stuff, this thing that I'm engaged with, the information. it's a can of worms, basically. When you start looking at what information actually is, you can go into the whole realm of quantum physics and stuff, What isn't information? Everything is information. And there's even a row still kind of going on because in physics, they believe that there is a finite amount of information that is the universe. Information just changes form, But Hawking says, or said at least, that some information gets destroyed in a black hole, and there's all this big argument going on about, can information be destroyed or not? And so that's a whole other rabbit hole to go down. But basically, what I'm looking at is information in the sense of the stuff that we ingest, for want of a better word. I don't really know what we do after we ingest it, but we certainly ingest a lot of it. Language, advertising, billboards, images, or saturated with images. Color, even. It's hard to believe that like about 120, 150 years ago, most people wore brown or kind of off-white. We get to see reds and blues and purples and all sorts of stuff. That's all new information. We didn't evolve necessarily looking at those colors, except in flowers, perhaps. With regards to this subject, there was a physicist called Max Planck, and he used to give this talk in the 20s, and he got kind of bored giving the same talk over and over again, and his chauffeur learned it by heart. So he asked his chauffeur to give the talk. And so afterwards, he said, I've given this talk a lot. My chauffeur will give the talk. He doesn't have an accent. I'll take a Q&A afterwards. So he took the Q&A. And if he thought the question was dumb enough, he'd refer to the chauffeur. My chauffeur can answer that. Or he'd then answer the more complicated questions. So there's a saying that goes around in some circles. Do you have Max Planck logic or knowledge or chauffeur knowledge? And with regards to this subject, certainly I've got chauffeur knowledge. But this information that we consume drives everything in our lives. When you think about it, it shapes our reality, and in a very powerful way. Google's algorithm is based on... when you do a search, it looks for the sites that are most linked to with regards to that search. So they'll come up, the most linked to sites will come up in a kind of a ranking order. That's kind of how it works. And that was an amazing insight that they had. So, you will get your information pretty quickly when you do your search with Google. The thing is, what that tends to do is it reinforce our biases. Well, I don't know if that's a word, our biases. So if you think about it, before Google, when the internet was around in the heady days of the mid-90s, people used to talk about it being a great equalizer, you know, the information all pervading everywhere, global village, you know, you'd be able to kind of be in touch with people around the world, bring the whole world together in a great community. But today we're in a different space. It's what it's done is it's kind of walled us off into these little bubbles where we're very, we get our own biases, our biases reconfirmed. It's like that old adage, when you carry around a hammer all day, everything starts to look like a nail. And we're kind of, you know, we have our own little niche hammers when it comes to the internet. So when I look at my own habits, I have to ask, you know, what's my intention when I go online? I go online to distract myself, maybe from uncomfortable feelings. I procrastinate. You know, if there's stuff I don't want to do, I tend to kind of read the Washington Post. FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. The fear of also seeming to be misinformed. Need to know stuff in case I get into a really heady conversation with somebody, which rarely ever happens. And also it reinforces my sense of righteous outrage about certain things too. I get, you know, my own fear and my anxiety and my despair, my apathy that I get sometimes about the whole political situation, I can get some really good reinforcement online very quickly. But the thing about going online is I heard it said on the radio or somewhere recently that the golden rule of the internet is you can never do just one thing on the internet, you know. You might say, oh, what is that? What's that recipe for jam? Oh, let's see, it's pectin, sugar. Trump did what? Oh my God. And you're off and running. Yes, I can, you know, I've seen many an hour go by wasted in such a procrastination. There was this political scientist in the 1950s by the name of Herbert Simon. And he wrote, you know, he's not really well known, but in 1950 he wrote, I think it's 1950, in an information-rich world, the wealth of information means a dearth of something else, a scarcity of whatever it is that information consumes. What information consumes is rather obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. Hence, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention and a need to allocate that attention efficiently among the overabundance of information sources that might consume it. Boiled down, it's basically the more info, the less attention span. And I think we're in the midst of some kind of social upheaval when it comes to that kind of stuff. I was on a plane last year, and as the plane came into land and sort of taxied in, people were whipping out their phones right away and straight into it. It was really extraordinary. I remember just like being really, because I hadn't been on a plane for a long time, and it was the first time I'd been on a plane in a while, and I hadn't seen that kind of behavior before. And yet it's everywhere. If you walk down the street, you see people are staring into their phones. So what do we do in our cushions here at the Zendo? We stop and we try to pay attention to whatever's going on with us in this moment. And that's a very, very old practice. It goes back to the God knows when it goes back to, but it's very, very old. And it was begun in an age where information was probably local, probably had to do with the weather, you know, when's the wheat ready to be cut, that kind of thing. And we're even then people understood the necessity to stop and pay attention. So in this day and age, where does this practice meet our life? How does it meet our life? When I was beginning as a Zen student here, somebody once said, and I think I said this at my Shuso talk, when does my life end and my practice begin? When does my practice begin and my life end? And I remember being very struck by that. What is not practice? What is practice? What is not practice? Roshi says that practice is really simple, and it is. It's coming back to this breath, this moment, restraining their wandering puppy of a mind, bring them back, him or her back, sit her down. So the other day I was online and listening to a podcast. Actually, I was multitasking. I was visual editing sound information that had been converted to visual representation while listening to somebody. It was quite, it's really a very 21st century thing to do. I was editing sound but listening to a podcast. And it was an anthropologist by the name of Dana Boyd. And she has this niche position where she was a computer scientist back in the 90s. And so she was in on the first browsers, developing the first browsers, the structure of the internet. And she began to see how people were interacting with their computers. And she found that actually to be more interesting. So she went back to school and trained as an anthropologist. And so what she does now, she examines people's behavior online and what this thing that we're dealing with is. When I say thing that we're dealing with, I mean we are dealing with something very serious at the moment, because our current state of politics has been shaped almost exclusively by the web. And that, I don't think that that's quite ever happened before. So the interviewer said, they went through this whole hopeless discussion about this, that, and the other, and they got kind of down on themselves. And the interviewer said, what should we do? How should we really approach just going online for the better? And she said something that really struck me. She said, what is your intention when you go online? Ask yourself, what is your intention, first and foremost? And then ask yourself, what role are you playing in the institutions that are the structure of the internet? What is your role? It's about being mindful of that media ecology, being mindful of your participation in that media ecology. I'm doing this Path of Practice class this year, and we're looking at the Eightfold Path. In the light of being active participants in our society, bodhisattva citizens. And one of the seminal parts of the Eightfold Path is right intention. It goes right view, right intention, right speech, right thought, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right concentration. Right intention. And I came across this little anecdote the other day. A teacher by the name of Xiang Lin, back in the day, he would teach his assembly, wherever you go traveling on foot to search for men of knowledge, you must bring along the eye to distinguish initiate from uninitiated, to tell shallow from deep, then you'll be all right. First, you must establish your resolve, just as old man Shakyamuni did when he was in the causal ground. Wherever he taught or spoke, it was always to set his resolve. If we just blindly give ourselves over to the winds of the internet, we're kind of giving up something, really. Boyd was talking about the Netflix algorithm and how once upon a time, you know, you'd order your serious movie and you'd probably get recommendations for other serious movies. But it began to do kind of like try to figure out what it is that you really liked. And so the algorithms were very insidious. It gives you kind of the cotton candy stuff rather than the serious stuff. And so, when presented with the option of kale or Lucky Charms, people tend to go for the Lucky Charms. But the Lucky Charms, of course, give you a headache the next day and make you feel like shite, really. But anyway, so she said before the internet, there was an inherent and, if unarticulated, understanding that freedom of speech meant freedom to hear. And right now, what we're doing is we drown out everybody else, except the little few people that we want to hear. We're drowning out the others. And that struck me when she said that too, because we, in our practice, we talk about bearing witness to the suffering of the world. And if you come to Fusatsu here, sometimes you'll hear a teacher talk about the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who listens to the cries of the world. And that's an energy that we all have access to. It's within us. It's in our nature to be compassionate, to be ready to help, to listen to the cries of the world. But that's very hard if we're drowning out the cries of the world, if we're walling ourselves off. So we need to ask ourselves, what's our intention when we go online or when we engage with our media? Where is our attention and what is our intention? T.S. Eliot kind of foresaw this in some respects when he wrote in his play Choruses from the Rock. Sorry, my mouth's really dry now. I'm going to have a sip of tea. All right. He said, where is the life we have lost with living? Where is the wisdom we have lost with knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost with information? So Roshi was talking recently about her colleague Neil Postman when she was at NYU. He wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death in the early 80s, and it was about television, really. That was the big thing on his mind. Incidentally, I first came to the States in 1987 as a student. I was doing my last semester at drama school and first year here. And anyway, I arrived a few days ahead of my student mates for reasons I won't go into. But I got to JFK and I was freaked out by these big leatherette sort of sofa seats that had these black and white TVs in the armrests. And people would just put quarters in and there was just rows of people just staring like zombies. And I thought that was like obscene. At the time, I thought it was absolutely obscene. I said, oh my God, only in America, you know. Little did I know. But Postman talks about something in that book called the information to action ratio. And it goes something like this. He framed it in the context of the telegraph. He said, prior to the telegraph, people received information that was relevant to their lives. As I was saying earlier, information that was sufficiently close to what most people had a sense of being able, the information action ratio was sufficiently close that most people had a sense of being able to control some of the contingencies of their lives. But the telegraph allowed for information to travel long distance, and so the local and the timeless lost their central position to newspapers. The local and the timeless were eclipsed by the dazzle of war, crimes, crashes, fires, floods, you name it. So a low information to action ratio, therefore, refers to the hopelessness people are confronted with when they are confronted with decontextualized information. Another way of saying decontextualized information could be bullshit. information consumers, oh, I can't move my mouth, all right. Information consumers are faced with, when we have an overconsumption of information, we're faced with a diminished social and political potency. In other words, we're disarmed by the information. Our agency in the world is lessened. That brought, my mind goes all over the place. That brought to mind something that was touched upon in our class, the Kalama Sutra. So the Kalamas were these people that lived at a crossroads in a town called Kesaputa in India. And it was a big commerce town, so there was people coming from all over the world, you know, China, whatever. They all passed through. But every day there were all these new gurus coming to town, extolling their spiritual paths, and they got quite confused. And the Buddha came along one day and was doing the same kind of thing. And they were like, look, how are we supposed to tell who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth? We're really confused. We're in doubt. And the Buddha said, of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference. By analogies, by agreement through pondering views. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted or carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. Is our participation in this media ecology harmful? Are we harming others? Do we contribute to the harm of others? It's worth thinking about, I think. I'm not advocating that everybody go home tonight and throw their phones off the Brooklyn Bridge. You know? We need our devices, unfortunately. I heard these guys talk about a thing called the yellow pad exercise. And it was basically, if you're on the computer doing work and you feel like you need to look something up, or you need to, your mind goes, check that out. Write it down on the yellow pad. Instead of doing it, just write it down on the yellow pad or a piece of paper or whatever. And after an hour or so, look back over those things and see if you really, 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 really need to know that stuff. You probably don't. It's just, you know, a manifestation of our monkey mind. This winter we were studying the dual mirror awareness, and so I was interested in Dongshang Liangji, the guy who wrote it. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful, seminal piece of text at the heart of our Soto tradition, and we chanted one retreat. And Dongshan encourages very much active expression of practice in our daily lives. And his teacher, Yunyan, said, don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from self. But we need to ask, you know, What is others and what is self? So we're preparing for Ango again. And for those who don't know, Ango means it's a traditional period of intensive practice, usually done about twice a year in a lot, I think, most Buddhist traditions. And it probably harkens back to the monsoon period, when everybody had to kind of stay indoors because it rained for like 2 months straight. And so we do two periods in the year. We do 3 months over the winter, and we do about 5 weeks in summer. And we're coming up on our Ango now. Ango means peaceful dwelling, or peaceful abiding. And going on retreat We go into silence for maybe a week, 10 days. And that can be either kind of a blessing or a curse. It can be kind of, you know, great or horrible, depending on what state your mind's in. And then again, you can examine if that's what really means great, what really means horrible. Eventually, you come out and you've got to go back to the world. You've got to go back to your job and you've got to go back to your life and your cat and your, you know, your bills and stuff. Dongshan was very aware of this. And so he liked to encourage his students to go out into the world and engage with the world and bring their meditative awareness with them. There's a koan, I haven't studied it, but I know of it. I think somebody must have spoken about it once, about the where Dongshan asks his students to go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. Go to that place. And one of the monks says, outside the gate there's grass. And another monk goes, wait, you know, inside too. So what's the value of our practice if it's not going among the grass and the weeds? So I'm going to finish with a poem of Dongshan. I think Dongshan writes the most beautiful poetry. I mean, when you come across it, it's I think it's an undiscovered gem, I think. So I'm going to read this poem, but there are two things in it that might be confusing, so I'll tell you what they are first. He talks of the forest of thorns. And the forest of thorns is an image for the monastery or the zendo. You go into the forest of thorns, in other words, you know, a bunch of thorny brambles in your head or whatever it is. And he talks about the old tree and emancipation, or emaciation. And that's referring to the Buddha under the tree, you know, having emaciated himself. So here's the poem. Grass. Boundless. Inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. To set foot inside the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look! Look! How many kinds! For while going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning.